calling this program here tonight, Minnesota and Race in the 21st Century. Why are we having a program on race tonight? Well, as I said, when we look at the overall theme for this season, the state of the state, it seemed obvious that this simply had to be one of our topics. It really was serendipity that this date that was available at the Varsity, and when we wanted to do this topic, fell on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. We thought that was especially appropriate and just really cool, actually. So Minnesota is going to be a very different place in 2025 than it is today. How do we prepare for that? It's going to be a place where, you know, Nakimi used the phrase silver tsunami, I think, sometime recently. There's going to be a mass retirement. We've talked about that already on Policy and a Pint just within the past year. The jobs themselves that are being vacated, well, the jobs aren't going to be the same ones. The jobs are changing radically. On top of all this, Minnesota, of course, as is the rest of the country, is going to be significantly more diverse, Minnesota in its own unique ways. How do we systematically prepare our state, our workforce, our communities, for this more diverse population? When we talk about race, it's tempting to do a number of things. Less than ideal things, possibly. Congratulate ourselves on how far we've come. I mean, that's certainly something that's valid, and we do that a lot, and we do that on a day like today to a certain degree, but it's obviously problematic. We are tempted to shy away from the hard stuff. We're going to talk about that a lot tonight, I would imagine. I'm going to ask the question, are Minnesotans more likely to shy away from hard conversations about this? It's not a polite topic, right? Well, why is that? Worse of all, we're tempted in some cases to scapegoat, to blame, to refuse to actually look for solutions. We see a lot of that in our society. It's as fresh as today's headlines, right? I don't follow sports, but what's the name of the football player who made half of white America freak out yesterday?
Sharman.
Sure, yeah. I mean, good Lord. So we want a productive conversation. We want it. You want it. We want to talk about reality and how we can come together as a society. Now, this is obviously a topic that's so huge and so complex that any presumption that some little program that NPR and the Citizens League is going to do, it can truly, you know, scratch the surface of, you know, that's just what it is. It's presumptuous that we're going to be able to do justice to a topic like this tonight. But we at NPR and the Citizens League do see this as, we're hopeful, a contribution to this ongoing important and difficult conversation. And it's a topic that's a key part of our series this year, as we've said, and we will approach this program tonight with the respect for the magnitude of the subject matter. And when we all go home tonight, we have very humble hopes that we'll have sort of one thing that we will be able to do tomorrow. One thing we'll be able to do differently tomorrow, think differently about, act on differently tomorrow. It's very much my honor to have these esteemed guests here with me tonight. Nakima Levy-Pounds is a law professor at the University of St. Thomas. She has a fan base. I love it. It's awesome.
I told my students that they would get A's if they screamed when.
So. If there's a vocal ovation. Excellent. All right. Yes, a law professor at the University of St. Thomas and the director of the Community Justice Project, an award-winning civil rights legal clinic. She is also chairwoman and founder of Brotherhood, Inc., a nonprofit dedicated to breaking the cycles of poverty and incarceration facing young black men in the Twin Cities. Antonio Cardona is the director of Pillsbury United Community's Urban Institute for Service and Learning. Mr. Cardona has worked with a wide range of nonprofit organizations and specializes in program development, public health, and leadership development programs. And Chris Stewart is the... please. Woo. And Chris Stewart is the executive director of the African American Leadership Forum. AALF's universal goal is, quote, a just and healthy society that works equally well for everyone. It also strives for a vital and healthy African American community that uplifts the rest. Mr. Stewart is also a former member of the Minneapolis Board of Education. So a round of applause for Mr. Stewart and all of our guests here tonight. How this works, if anyone is new to Policy in a Pint, is that I spend some period of time. How much have I already blown yammering up here? Way too much time. Good Lord. So I take about half an hour to interview our guests. I hope that we have until about quarter past tonight, since I've eaten up way too much time already. So I will interview our guests for 20 minutes to 30 minutes. And then I'll come out with my nice wireless mic here, and I'll take questions for you. Please have your questions ready. The only rule that I've got is I hold the mic. Please do not try to grab it from me.
Oh, I love it.
Other than that, you know, it's open tonight. So can you guys first just talk in layman's terms about what it is that your organizations, your specific organizations that I mentioned in the header, like what they do, like, you know, in reality, rather than just, I have a general idea given from this, but I would like to know, sort of like, sum it up for me, the AALF.
In a nutshell. So the African American Leadership Forum continuously convenes the African American community. We primarily look to build social capital amongst black leaders and members of the black community so that we could come up with policy solutions that fit our own needs and involve the community within the solutions for our own community.
And Nakima, the Community Justice Project is boil that down for me. What is the sort of day and day?
So the Community Justice Project, or CJP, is a civil rights legal clinic. And we essentially work to champion the cause of justice on behalf of communities of color. So we find out about particular issues that people are concerned about, whether it's negative interactions with law enforcement or disparities in public education. Once we find out what the issues are, we may do research, we may hold town hall forums, but ultimately our goal is to get towards solutions. So that might mean interfacing with a government stakeholder or the legislature in order to bring about change. We're also somewhat of a think tank as well. We've produced a number of reports that have led to changes in laws and policies here in our state.
There was a report that you were talking about this morning on NPR News. Is that one that was generated by your organization as well, that was about the disparities? And we'll get to that and talk about that, actually, because that's a significant sort of linchpin of some of the things that we'll talk about tonight. Antonio, the Urban Institute for Service and Learning.
Sure. So Pillsbury United Communities is a multi-service agency that has five locations around the city. My shop is really the training, leadership development, and education wing of Pillsbury. So we operate a program called Public Allies Twin Cities, which is a leadership development program that's full-time for diverse young leaders, moving them into, you know, significant power or positions of leadership in nonprofit organizations. And then we oversee 27 charter school locations serving 6,000 kids and a few other social enterprises. And then we just recently opened a training facility over in North Minneapolis.
Cool. Okay. So now I want to obviously, I talked in my open about how problematic spending time talking about the positive things that have happened over the past 50 years, how that can be a sort of dead-end conversation. But I do want to, 50 years since the March on Washington, 50 years since the civil rights struggles of the 1960s, can we sort of begin by framing briefly some of the positive changes and use that as a touching-off point to talking about the continued systematic problems that we have today by, you know, point of comparison to where we began, how far we've come, and then cite some specific, say, statistics, if you have them in your minds, about education, incarceration, homeownership. This is just, I know it's a very, very broad-reaching topic, but I have a feeling that you might have some things to say that are right there in your noggin, ready to go about this idea. Whoever wants to start on that, I'm going to nominate Nikema, actually, to do that.
Thank you.
I know my students are having a blast seeing him in the hot seat. I would say in terms of the changes, I mean, one key one is the fact that we could be here in this venue, blacks, white, Latinos, Asians, and gathering together as a community without restrictive laws saying that that is not acceptable or that it is illegal. So I think that that's one key change, the fact that we can gather. I would also say the passing of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which made it illegal to discriminate against African Americans or other people of color with regard to public accommodations. So again, that's another key example. We also know that Brown versus the Board of Education in 1954 said that separate schools were inherently unequal for blacks and whites. Now, although in theory, we know that there are still challenges in terms of integrating our public school system, at least on the books, under the law, things have changed. So I see that as being very positive as well.
On the books, under the law, right. Okay.
Yes.
Now then we talk about the de facto changes that haven't happened, perhaps. See, that's a whole nother topic, right? So again, what I want to do is talk about disparities in employment, in education, incarceration, the broader economics. I mean, people who run companies, sit on boards, head up organizations, that sort of stuff. There are an awful lot of disparities that we could talk about tonight. And where shall we begin?
I mean, should we talk about where there's not a disparity?
Sure.
I don't know where that is.
All right. There you go.
I'm stumped. So I'll say this. There are a lot of places where we can see that there have been obviously some gains. Positional power. We have more people who actually are rising into positions that we've never seen people of color be in those positions before. We see people integrating places. We have the first congressman who's a Muslim and who's an African American serving as a congressman. These are kind of like high water marks. But the thing that it does a lot of times is it fools us into believing that these independent victories are actually victories for the whole community. And I think that's where we're missing. So as much as we have a black president, there's still a lot of companies that are probably 20 years away from having a black president. I think there's 4% black CEOs leading all of corporate America, or less, right? And that's an enormous amount of power to have, in some ways probably more power than the actual president of the United States. We have disparities in education, disparities in criminal justice, unequal treatment through most of our major systems and our major institutions. On the one hand, we have Obama and we have Keith Ellison, and we have these kind of high-profile wins and gains, like Oprah Winfrey, if I hear her name one more time in one of these discussions. What about Oprah? And I'm like, well, I was just hanging out with my friends, the billionaires, last week. Not, right? Wasn't happening. So, I mean, we have these kind of high-profile wins that give people kind of like an out-of-proportion sense for where we are. And that is the thing that I think we have to tackle, because I think it makes us so smug about how far we've come, when in actuality we have people that are still suffering and have needless suffering on a daily basis because they're being shut out of the American mainstream, and it's something that we could correct, but we don't.
Who is we who is smug?
Y'all. That's always the answer, no matter who you ask.
Okay.
Right? So I think, you know, here's the thing. I'm not from Minnesota. Right? So Minnesota is one of the places in the nation where you have this fantastic, I think, economy, a way of life that worked very well for many people for many years. It's a communal kind of European system where people have each other's back, kind of a farm system. I just don't think that they adopted the newcomers in a way that integrated everybody into kind of this booming lifestyle. So there is a smug sense of, we've done so well. So if the systems aren't working for you, there must be something inherently deficient about you, because it has worked for all of us for so long. I see how you can have that
As a characteristic of a state, it's just not going to get us very far in the future.
Antonio, you want to get in on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think the key that I see with what Chris is saying is that we do become seduced by individual progress being taken as generalized progress, and how that can lead us to this idea that we're somehow better off than we actually are. And I think the thing that I think about often is in this shift in attitude between generations, I think. And I think if we think about systemic factors affecting race and racism and interpersonal pieces, there, I think when you look at generational shifts, there's more interpersonal shifts, I think, that are going to come before the systemic ones. So certainly we can become, again, seduced by incrementalism. Okay, we have this law, now this policy, this has gotten a little bit better, this statistic looks a little bit better. But I think if you are trying to just look at systems, that's, of course, important. But if you don't really address interpersonal interaction and communication, a lot of these things aren't really going to go away. You know, so that's why I think that's something like what the YWCA does is really important, because that's about two individuals, one-on-one or small groups of people. And then if you look at a younger generation, just by how, you know, increased connectivity has led us to where we are, a lot of younger people see themselves more as global citizens. And so I think the more people interpret themselves as that, the more some of these other barriers are going to just naturally fall away, because a lot of young people don't see themselves as different as another person just because they were born in another country or speak a different language or, you know, have a different interest. Some of that is falling away. And so I think that gets us to where we are now a little bit more. Mm-hmm.
I always forget to encourage you to go to Twitter. Hashtag PolicyPint is the place to go if you want to submit a comment there, if you want to submit a question there. And I'll try my best to keep up on those, even though I'm terrible at it. But I will really do my best. But that's the place to go to have the conversation, and that's also the place where it can continue after the show online. Antonio, quick, I wanted to follow up on something you said. Did you say that interpersonal changes are happening, or they need to happen because that's the place where they have to happen first, or both?
Both. I mean, I think by nature of an increasing younger generation, that's going to happen naturally. But I think that there's some intentionality that has to happen around how people communicate and interact with one another. You know, so for example, it's wonderful to think about how to address, you know, the achievement gap or the opportunity gap, and what laws do we need to put in place or start this type of school or reform this portion. But I mean, realistically, if you have an individual who, let's say, they graduate from high school and they're trying to get a job, or even interact in social circles, you know, if you have an individual who is, let's say, a Caucasian person and they're talking to another Caucasian person, that interaction is going to be different than when they shift focus to a non-Caucasian person. You know, things around like eye contact or, you know, mm-hmm. how believable you're taking, you know, what they say. I think it's those interpersonal things that are really at kind of the meat of the things that need to change.
I have the sense that I can just sort of let this keep going because I see you wanted to get in on that. So did you have something that you wanted to sort of bounce off there?
Yeah, I kind of want to challenge the paradigm that I think many of us have bought into regarding how mainstream white Minnesotans have been able to really get ahead with, in our society. And, you know, as Chris was talking about, because of the success that's enjoyed by mainstream white Minnesotans, people tend to blame communities of color when they don't actually achieve to that same level. But I think one of the things that struck me about being a part of this community is the notion that we have been lying to ourselves for a very long time. So when you look at what happened to Native Americans here, we've never honestly acknowledged how we treated Native Americans, how we got this land, how we've been able to build these institutions and marginalize those who did not have access to power. So because the whole foundation is built upon a lie, it really makes it difficult to buy into what I think we had an excellent PR person who sort of sold us a bill of goods about what it means to be a Minnesotan, you know, land of 10,000 lakes, land of a number of Fortune 500 companies. Not only can you have a main residence, but you can go buy a cabin. And so that is sort of the paradigm that we've been taught about our state, but when you peel back the layers, again, you look at how Native Americans have been treated. You look at African Americans who've been here for 100 years and the fact that many of them have remained on the fringes of society. You look at how we treat newcomers. You look at the fact that Minneapolis at one point was seen as the most anti-Semitic city in the country. You look at the fact that we had the Ku Klux Klan running rampant in our state. Those are truths that we rarely talk about, and I think that those truths, even though they're uncomfortable truths, they're difficult truths, need to be incorporated in a new narrative about who we are. No, we can't change what happened in the past, and this isn't about being guilty. This is about moving beyond guilt and focusing on action and solutions to actually shift what's happening right now.
Right on. Does everybody just want to have some coffee instead of a beer, and we could just go for like 4 hours on this tonight? We could actually maybe really do some awesome stuff here, I think.
I want more beers.
Really?
Some Patron.
Antonio, you mentioned, you said the achievement gap, and then you followed up by saying the opportunity gap right away. I know that achievement gap, Nikiva, is a phrase that you can't stand.
It's my pet
peeve. Right. Okay, talk about that.
No offense to anyone, but it is very difficult for me to tolerate the language of the achievement gap, primarily because I think it's a misnomer. The term achievement gap actually puts the onus or the blame for the problems on the children, as opposed to the system that's constructed, which actually perpetuates the disparities that exist within our system. For me, language matters a lot. And it's also very personal. I mean, now, yes, I'm a law professor, I'm a civil rights attorney, but I grew up in the inner city of Los Angeles. I lived in one of the poorest communities where we did not have access to equal opportunity. And it was really through education. I went off to a boarding school when I was 14 on the East Coast, got a full scholarship. And there, in that experience of being in really what was a land of opportunity, I saw the differences between the educational system in Los Angeles Unified School District versus a prep school in Massachusetts. And so it showed me that the deficit wasn't in the blacks and Latinos who had to attend LA Unified School District because of their socioeconomic status. It had to do with who had access to opportunity, who had access to the best books. Many of our books were written in and passed along from the suburbs. Pages were torn out. We just had to get what was sent to our school. We didn't get to take lavish trips. In fact, we went to one trip in a suburban area, and there were white kids there who said, ew, they're from the ghetto. And we were just happy to get out of our neighborhood. But when I went off to that boarding school, I realized you could travel the world. They had exchange programs. They had professional people from around the country coming in to train us. People had gone to Harvard and other institutions. So to me, it's structural and it's systemic. And I can't sit by and blame the children for the problems that they didn't create.
We have systemic problems. We have issues that occur on a macro scale. Then we have the sort of micro scale, interpersonal. We've talked about them. We've talked about eye contact and interpersonal, the sort of Minnesotan uncomfortable about talking about X, Y, and Z, having these difficult conversations. Where do we begin? Where do we actually begin? Let's say on the macro level, because let's say we have more African Americans represented on school boards and on boards of directors and whatnot. How does that actually how does that actually translate to changes in policy? Give me examples on how that actually translates to changes in structural change.
So, one thing I'll say is when you think about diversity and who's in the room and, who's making the decisions and whatnot, you have to ask yourself whether or not you think that diversity is just for purposes of a head count or if you think it makes a material difference into the way that decisions are being made when different people bring things to the table. The way I usually describe this to people a lot of times is if I ever come to a meeting about women's reproductive rights and it's all dudes sitting around a table,
sure,
I'm leaving, right?
You're what? You're leaving.
I'm leaving, right? It's not the meeting for me because, right, the room is just set wrong. So in my perfect world, my white ally friends, if they ever walked into a room that was about social justice and the whole room was white, they would leave, right? And that's not because it's about a head count or it's about just a certain number of people being in a room. I think there's a material difference when people bring different lived experiences into a room that is going to decide how we shape our communal institutions, right?
Yep. You guys want to jump in? I mean, this is where we're going to start to get down to what I think is and you know, maybe ultimately with the way that society is going to change over the next 10 to 20 to 50 years, we simply won't be having this kind of conversation in the future. But you know, I grew up in a very right-wing family. And I encountered some sort of opinions about things that were, to, as an adult today, to me are horrifying. But I still get an awful lot of exposure to, let's say, recalcitrance, to accepting any sort of idea beyond the individual responsibility argument and you know, all that sort of thing. There's not going to be any sort of receptiveness to conversations of systematic, you know, problems with the system and structural, and you know, I could go home and talk for hours about, you know, do you really think that George W. Bush was a fantastic student and that's the reason he got into Yale? It doesn't really matter, you know, but it's going to fall on deaf ears to a segment of the population that is getting their own prejudices constantly reinforced. So, as I say, maybe this is not something which is going to be a problem in 10, 20, 30 years because of the sort of sea change demographically that you're talking about, Antonio. But it is a problem that we have now. So, what is the model, what is the method for having actual, substantive, real conversations when we go home to the dinner table and talk about real solutions and get beyond racism, essentially, so, with our white families, with me and my, you know, fellow white people, basically.
So this is something that I've thought a lot about, and I think there's a YouTube video of me talking about this that people didn't really like very much. But my idea around this is in a negotiated generational shift is kind of what my idea is. So the idea is that we have all these folks that are older, who are still holding a lot of positions of power in the political realm, in corporations, and I think the way that we're going to get to what you're talking about is in doing something that we've never really done before and having some sort of managed transition where you are intentionally bringing down decision-making authority out of the hands of an older generation to a younger generation intentionally. So that way, you know, you have like a Harry Reid and a John Boehner. They're very entrenched in these ideas on opposite sides of the aisle, but they really have the exact same problem. They're not willing to move out of that. You know, you have older generations who they have specifically structured the world and society to look like how they want it to look like. So you have things like Medicare, Medicaid, retirement. You know, you want to have safety. And those things are always going to be held with a death grip. And am I saying that we shouldn't have that? No, not necessarily. But a lot of the issues that we have, you know, if you look at the current playing out of politics and how society is structured, you have to respect your elders, wait till you get into that position of power to change things. And a lot of the things that we have now can't wait 30 or 40 years to be addressed. And the older generation is not really going to address them. So what does that mean if you purposefully put in 30-somethings into positions of power that is usually held for a 50- or 60-year-old? Certainly the 50- or 60-year-olds aren't going to like that very much, but I think it's an interesting idea.
Okay, guys? Yeah.
I think it depends on the 30-year-old. And you know? Sure. The reality has to do with the fact, again, most of us have come up through the public education system where we have been trained a certain way. And what is taught reinforces a system that many call a system of white supremacy. And that's essentially a system that says that whites are superior and everyone else is on the bottom. Now, not only is that message sent out to your average white person or white family, it's sent out to people of color as well. So a lot of times we're taking in these same messages and we're internalizing those messages, and it impacts our feelings of our self-worth, whether we think that we can compete on the same level, whether we think that we're as smart, whether we think that we can run a city or a state or a country. And those things over time have a negative cumulative effect. So I think, one, a managed transition is not going to happen on its own, although I would love the idea. It goes back to something that Frederick Douglass said, which is that power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will. So to expect this system to suddenly shift because you have a certain number of people in their, you know, younger years who are willing to push for change, I think we would have a huge war on our hands. And we already, you know, have seen historically how this country is willing to go to war and split itself apart when you have factions that disagree about what is at the essence of a country and what their beliefs are. So I'm talking about the Civil War and slavery. So I think looking forward, what we're going to have to do is what Dr. King called have a revolution of values, where we change what we're taking into our system in terms of movies, in terms of what we read in the paper. Are we willing to question the narratives that are put forth, even if they send us an implicit message that certain people are inferior or certain people are prone to criminality or they blame certain people? Most of us take this information in on a daily basis, and rarely do we challenge it. So before you know it, it seeps into your subconscious, and that translates into actions. So that if you're a 30-year-old and you get into a position of power, if you have not challenged what you've been taught, you're prone to make the same mistakes.
Like, I feel like we're missing a person here. So this is what I'll say, and this is going to sound just a little bit cynical. I honestly don't know what the answer is. I do know that we're staring down a future where we're facing some major changes in the way that things get done and the way that we'll be able to do business. The demographics are changing, the nature of business is changing, and I don't know that our institutions are geared to keep up with what the challenge is going to be. When I listen to this part of the conversation, what I hear is this major need for a reckoning. There needs to be a reckoning. There needs to be a payment of the debt. There needs to be a thing that really sets justice off. And the scary part about that is I don't see any evidence that that's what people are ready to do. As a matter of fact, I see people who are still profiting from the things being the way that they are. You know, the way that you succeed in politics right now is to live in a bifurcated world. It is to live in a divided world. And it is not to actually take care of these things that we actually need to have a reckoning about from the past. So we have this major challenge. The state's changing, the nature of business is changing, the nature of education is changing, but are the people themselves ready to change? One thing that I think that's missing from these previous generations is that young people really set things off. Several times in the last century, young people got fed up. I just don't know if we're there anymore. To tell you the truth, we're a much more consumerist country than we were there then. We have much more neutralized values. We have more people who are willing to put their values in their back pocket just to play the game. So that might sound cynical. I hope that didn't bum you out too much or, you know, harsh your mellow too much, but it's where I think we are.
Well, I want to come back. I want to take some questions, but Nikema, I want to make sure we don't get out of here before asking you if you're optimistic about the revolution in values. Okay.
It depends on who's leading it.
Uh-huh.
There is a part of me that is optimistic because I look back at what has happened historically and I realize, again, as we talked about earlier, some gains have been made. The question is, who is willing to step up to the plate and put their livelihood on the line? Sometimes putting your life on the line. I think that this is an especially timely conversation in honor of Dr. King's birthday, because that's exactly what happened. I mean, people walked into police dogs and fire hoses and nightsticks and angry mobs of white people who didn't want change to happen, yet they did it anyway because they believed in freedom, justice, and equality. So the question is, I mean, there are so many people in this audience who are energized about this conversation and willing to step outside of their comfort zone. That alone makes me optimistic. But the question beyond this is who's willing to do more than talk and actually act after we leave here tonight? And right. that'll help explain your answer.
Sure. Mm-hmm. All right. My first question here, and holy cats, what time is it? Okay, here we go. First question.
Well, here, I don't know if people know what I'm talking about here, but I just want to set this up with a quote from Dr. King. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. And I'm just, now Dr. King was in Memphis fighting for a group of people who are looking to get collective bargaining rights with the city of Memphis.
Sanitation workers.
Yes, ma'am. AFSCME Local 1733, in fact. And I'm wondering, when you talk about systematic change, are collective bargaining rights on your radar screen as a way to achieve that?
I probably shouldn't answer that question. I get in enough trouble on Twitter when talking about unions. Chris, I'll let Chris start it off.
Yeah. You know, here's the thing. So I actually believe in the romantic notion of the right to collectively kind of control your destiny for workers to come together. Academically, it makes sense to me. Historically, it makes sense to me. But in some ways, that battle has not been won for a long time, right? There needs to be some creative movement. There needs to be a spark of something more revolutionary within the unionist movement to confront the times that we're in now. In some ways, unionism to me, and this will get me in trouble, but I'm going to say it anyways, unionism is like that mall that you used to go to, but you don't go to anymore, so some of the shops are closed, and some of the people are gone, and some of the people there look questionable and whatnot. That's what it looks like to me, and I'm just being real. If it was a winning strategy for us, I would say yes. If they were winning battles, and in some cases they are. So I want to make sure that I at least say that. SEIU and some of the more, I think, kind of radical unions who actually do remember their kind of old calling and their values are having some wins and some gains. Overall, I think they're kind of taking it on the chin.
Thank you, Chris. I mean, I'm just going to be honest, okay? So I mentioned I'm from L.A., to me, when I look at what's happening here as far as the unions, it really feels like a game. And that's not to say that it's not important for workers to unite and to negotiate equitable rights and equitable treatment. I think that that's absolutely in line with what Dr. King would have wanted. But what I see in many circumstances is a perversion of those values. And really what I'm talking about are unions that are able to use their political power to focus on what they want, which typically has to do with rights for the white majority, and people of color who you would think would benefit from some of those negotiated agreements typically do not. And I think when we look at our public education system, that's one example where you see a lack of teachers of color, a lack of diversity, and some of these are things that have been negotiated between districts and unions, not necessarily saying you can't have diversity, but that's the outcome of some of the policies that have been put in place. I also hear from people who work in construction, who are African American, in terms of how they've been treated by labor unions. So in many situations, these African American men, for example, have gone to school, they've learned a certain trade, and then they join a union. But when it's time to actually go out and do a job on a construction site, they're given menial tasks, like holding signs or put in very dangerous positions. This is not every union, but there are enough horror stories out there that leads me to believe that it requires further investigation. So I think until we correct the perverse nature of some of the things that are happening, it's very difficult to see the collective bargaining strategy as a way towards systematic change.
Our next question. Thank you, by the way.
Hi, thank you. It's more of a comment in discussing race and...
Sorry, I hold the mic.
In discussing race in America and in our social institutions, I think it's really important to keep in mind the idea of colorblindness. And this idea of modern racism. You know, racism today looks different than it did pre-civil rights. After civil rights, we had affirmative action. Everyone is treated equally. At least that's the idea. But really, does race matter? Should it matter? And so the idea in colorblindness, if you're colorblind, the idea is that race shouldn't matter, and it does not matter in determining people's outcomes in our social institutions. Whereas people who aren't colorblind, they believe that race shouldn't matter, but it does matter. And I think in today's society, we've been taught post-civil rights that we want to be colorblind. That's the ideal. That's what we strive for. We shouldn't pay attention to people's skin color, because before civil rights, there was segregation. There was Jim Crow atrocities. So we strove to be colorblind, but I think in doing that, it's doing a disservice, especially for people of color. So I just wanted to comment on that. And then also, I'm a researcher, and I've done some research on this idea of colorblindness. And in terms of law enforcement, there hasn't really been any research done on law enforcement in this idea of colorblindness. But black and white law enforcement officers, they have the same levels of colorblindness, and they're pretty colorblind. But if you look at the courts, black and white people working in the courts, black and white people working in child welfare, there's differences.
Okay, so lots there. You guys want to jump in? Go ahead.
Antonio.
Sure, I think two things on that. So one, and you said it yourself, you know, this idea that colorblindness really does a disservice to what we're really trying to do. I think it's foolish to ever think that you can be colorblind, and because, you know, if you look at how cognitively, you know, humans behave, first you recognize gender, and then the quick second piece that you recognize is somebody's race or how they look. So if you attempt to say that you're colorblind, what you're really doing is lying to yourself, because you automatically recognize it. And then if you talk about colorblindness in the context of policies or, you know, how things are constructed, if you don't recognize and value and celebrate people's individualism and the culture that they come from, yes, you're absolutely doing them a disservice, because you're saying you need to show up as a default or some sort of agreeable way of being, so that way you are somehow palatable to me. So colorblindness kind of takes all that away. The other thing, you know, you talk about affirmative action, and, you know, this idea that we're striving for a colorblind society, which I would challenge. I don't know that we are striving for that. Some people maybe, but I don't think we should. If you think about affirmative action, you know, some people will say, we don't need these sorts of things anymore. If we're trying to be colorblind, shouldn't we not look at race? I can't remember what some Supreme Court decision where John Roberts essentially said, if you don't want to discriminate on race, don't discriminate on race. And my answer to that is, those things can go away if you come to an ability to look at all of these statistics across the board, you know, educational attainment, housing gap, all of these disparities that we have. As soon as you can show me all of those statistics and they're flat or there is no disparity, then, yeah, maybe we can have a conversation that affirmative action or things like that need to go away. But until then, they're absolutely essential.
Chris, if you wanted to get in, just please move up on the mic a little more, if you would.
I don't know if I should be singing to you guys or what. You know, so intimate with the mic.
And on a piano.
So, you know, I think colorblindness is a way to absolve white guilt, and for people to feel like they've gotten to a place where, you know, where they've arrived.
You don't believe Bill O'Reilly is colorblind?
No. I think he's absolutely colorblind.
Really? Yeah.
I watch him every night. Not. So I think Nakima used the words earlier, white supremacy. So when we get lost down the kind of rabbit hole of race and color and am I racist and whatnot, we have a white supremacist system. So after slavery, the white supremacist system reorganized itself under Jim Crow. And after Jim Crow, it came under a new form of civil rights. And after civil rights, there was a post-civil rights stuff where actually white folks were even using civil rights laws against us. Actually, right? You know, you saw it just not many years after, affirmative action was there. People started suing. White folks started suing. And that was because we were doing this based on color. We weren't doing it based on justice. right? In none of those transitions did we ever ask for justice. We just asked to be equal, right, to be normed with everybody. And I think that's been the false promise of every one of these kind of transitions that we've made.
Next question.
Hello. I just first want to say thank you all for the work that you do. I really appreciate it. Especially shout out to Nikema Levy Pounds. Just as a black woman, you know, thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes. And so my question, though, I have for y'all is, so I do a lot of work with NOC, Neighborhoods Organizing for Change, and Occupy Homes Minnesota. Yes. And, you know, we're really interested, I think, in challenging corporate interests and how they play out in promoting racism and keeping us divided and keeping us distracted. And I think in the black community, especially the black communities that I've been a part of, like reaching that middle upper class, you know, level of living is like an ideal because we were denied it for so long. We are denied it still. And so, but the approach I'm bringing is like, okay, but if getting that means, you know, like the Indonesian fabric workers are dying underneath, you know, bricks and stuff, is that really what this looks like? And so I'm really interested in how you feel the role of corporate interests and this new economy that's setting us all up to fight for scraps against each other and you know, sort of magnify these differences of race to keep us at each other's throats and how we can start to integrate that more into discussions about race and a lot of things that we're working to change.
Thank you. Great question.
Why do you want to get me in trouble? This one's yours. You start with this one.
I live in trouble. That's what I see. No, that's a great question. I think it goes back, at least for me, when I'm looking at history. I look at what happened during the days of slavery, where you had blacks who were enslaved and indentured white servants working side by side. And the wealthy white landowners saw that as a threat. And so during that period of time, they actually implemented a system based on racial hierarchy. And that was intentionally injected into the system to keep people divided and distracted, when in reality, black slaves and white indentured servants had more in common than they realized. We've seen that same system perpetuated from one generation to the next, where people will put their own interests aside for the sake of keeping the system the way that it is. And they think that they're protecting their interests, their families, their offspring. But in reality, we wind up, as you were saying, kind of fighting for crumbs and distracted from the truth. And when I look at the studies that talk about how the rich continue to get richer, the rest of us continue to get poorer, the middle class continues to dwindle, we should recognize that there is a larger construct at play that benefits from keeping us divided and distracted. So we need to be intentional about having these conversations and making sure that we are checking ourselves in terms of how we view the other, and making sure that we're willing to fight for the other's interest, even if we think that it impacts our own.
So you know what I'll say about that, too, is in you know the black community, I'm certain that it's the same in a lot of other communities, the American story of wanting to get a good job and to come up and to feed your family and to do better than your previous generation did is something that's deeply ingrained in us. I know where I come from in New Orleans, it was, you know, if you get a good job and you get a job with benefits and you get a house, you've actually kind of made it. And that actually meant something in our community. And there are whole parts of black communities in the country that made it that way. So it puts us, I love your question, it puts us a little bit at odds because for a lot of those black middle class people, that was the brass ring. That was what was taught to them, a way to kind of do better for themselves and their children, their family, and leave behind a lot of pain and a lot of misery that took place in very poor communities, right? So I'm with you. I'll join with you to challenge corporate power, but I just want all the white folks to quit their jobs first in the corporations and let us keep working ours for another like 10, 15, 20 years and accumulate some wealth, because right now, black wealth is 5% of white wealth.
right? The average black household has 5% of the wealth of the average white household. And the average white household got that through educational attainment, home ownership, and a job, and probably a job in large part in corporate America. So if we're going to take down corporate America, I'm just like, y'all first, and then we'll come later.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with, you know, both of what you're saying. I think what I hear in your statement and question is kind of around what is progress rooted in. And I think what we seem to think about is that progress is rooted in your ability to make a certain amount of money and then buy things with that money. And so I think the question is what is the value of equality? Is it a value or is it a monetary amount? And value, I mean, like more of a principle. So, you know, I don't know if there's a word for it. The way that I talk about to other folks is externalizing discrimination and inequality. So, you know, in America, progress means you get more money, you buy more things, you know, you buy your iPhone in your pocket, a big flat screen TV. So that can give a sense that, you know, you yourself or communities are rising to a different level. But is that really achieving equity if all you're doing is externalizing all that, and meaning that you have folks in the global south that are being paid 4 cents an hour or 4 cents a day to make these things? Yeah, cool, we're all right now, but we're really just pushing that out to different countries.
Mm-hmm. We have, I've got my cohorts here helping me sort of take the questions as they've come in, and they're really going to start to build up. We're going to be able to go to 7:30. They're being very generous with us here at the Varsity, so we'll take as many questions as we can. Before I get to my next question, this has come in on Twitter a couple of times, and people want to talk a little bit more about Minnesota Nice and how that stands in our way of talking about this topic and making actual real, actually getting out in the open.
Well, Minnesota Nice is real. And it makes it difficult to have these kinds of conversations. I mean, that's why I said earlier, I look out at so many of you interested in engaging, and that makes me optimistic because you're willing to put that cultural stereotype aside to engage in a real discussion that I'm sure at times feels uncomfortable. I think when I've encountered Minnesota Nice, it's really been mostly people who don't want to talk about race, who feel really uncomfortable. And when you say something that is uncomfortable, they will say, oh, that's interesting. See, you all know what I'm talking about. And for me, being from LA, it's a completely different paradigm. I mean, I've had to learn how to navigate different rooms and different settings. But then I just got to the point where I just said, I'm just going to speak the truth. I'm sorry if it makes people uncomfortable, but that's what Dr. King did. We honor him every year. And yet, when it's time to actually go in a room and speak truth to power, most of us won't do it. So I just decided I'm going to go in, I'm going to speak the truth. And I'm not going to be as concerned about Minnesota Nice. I do typically warn people that I'm not, so that they will know more of what to expect.
That's kind of been my failing, is I don't warn people. I think I should. I'll say this about Minnesota Nice. I came to Minnesota with $300 and no place to live, and I got a job within 2 weeks. I had my third job within a month. I had a place to stay within 6 weeks to a month or 2 months. I kind of got set up, and all of that was from help from people, like the goodness of people. So my first kind of instinct about Minnesota when I got here was, oh my God, these people are like crazy nice. This isn't like, you know, kind of nice. This is like different than anything I've ever seen. And, you know, after Katrina, my family moved up here. Within like 2 weeks, we had probably like, I want to say like somewhere in the order of $30,000 worth of stuff that people just outpoured. They kind of rallied around my family, free van, free this. So there is something to this Minnesota Nice thing, right? I've lived in 13 cities and in several other states, and it is something that's here. There's also like bumper pool. There's a place at which it stops progress too, though. And that's when you want to talk about the tough issues. When we talk about our public education system, we get to this point where people, they almost think you're being too indelicate, and they don't like your manners about what you're saying. And if you go too far, they really want to marginalize you. Well, you know, that just is not the way that we say things, you know, that sort of thing. And the problem with that is
there are really people suffering every day in those schools who are on trajectory to have really bad lives, and we can predict it with very clear accuracy. So if we can't talk about it because we're being too nice, that's when the nice will kill you, right? Minnesota Nice loves you up on one hand, and in another hand, it will kill you.
Mm-hmm. You see it with road rage as well. At least I have, driving home. That's when the anger comes out, when you're on the road and you're like, that's not so nice. Or when you read the comment section.
That's exactly what I was going to say. You read the comment section.
Of the Star Tribune or Pioneer Press. Yeah.
Let it
be
an entire show on
that. Issue on race. Those are some of the meanest, nastiest, most racist comments. And they're not coming from the Deep South. They're coming from right here.
I think they're coming from North Dakota.
I think. Man, though, that is the steam belt, isn't it? That's terrifying. All right, next question.
Hi, I'm a Hispanic immigrant. I moved to this country when I was 30 years old, and I have lived in Florida and in Minnesota, so I have, like, both sides of experience. I would like to ask you, in my opinion, one of the biggest concerns, I understand that there are problems in the big mass and everybody struggles with racial issues. But from an outsider, from someone who lived most of their lives in another country, I would like to tell you that your biggest concern should be that really extreme right-wing pocket of people who get a lot of room to, you know, be seen and legitimacy, you know? So, I mean, really, from an outsider point of view, what do you think the strategies to really address the incredible extreme right-wing people who talk against immigrants, against race, or say incredible things on TV on a regular basis? I just, you know, find it shocking. And anybody who has moved to this country will tell you the same. So I would like to ask you, what are the strategies that you consider to address that incredible problem?
Is that something that we're going to see change generationally as well, or is this so much of a significant threat, as she would say?
I mean, the thing that I think about, I mean, if you just talk about journalism, we've convinced ourselves that there are two sides to every story and that those both have equal weight or should be implemented in a similar fashion. So then you have something happening and then, you know, you look at a Fox News to comment on something or a right-wing type of person to comment, and those ideas are given equal weight to whatever the flip of that is. And I think that that's a big challenge in just how naturally American brains work. Yeah, I don't know what else I was going to say.
I think this is a super insightful question, though, and I think there's something, you know, I don't have a great answer for this, but there's something about it that gives me the chills when you express it this way. And the reason that I think that this is a super insightful question, number one, when you look at Fox News for a day and then you look at, you know, CNN or something else for a day, you realize you're living in two different universes. But the thing that I get on the one side is this sense that they are so in fear and they feel like they're being backed into a corner, like their country is being taken from them. And that's when I get really fearful of white people, right? When white people feel like they're losing something big, like, you know, there's all this stuff about the demographic change. I just want you to know that just because we might become the majority doesn't mean we get the country. South Africa was a place where a small number of white folks who were very afraid and felt very kind of like Fox News-ish. So this question that you have, honestly, I don't have a great answer for it, but you are right on the money with how much this should give us the chills. Like, there are things that are being said and being done and things that we just take for granted. Oh, that's, you know, Sean Hannity. Don't kind of, you know, think about it. But Sean Hannity is talking to a large swath of America, right? And those people every day are listening to that, and they're just being, there's no way to sanitize them from that. So I don't know what to say except for you're asking a great question that I think we should all be concerned about.
Akima, did you want to join?
I would just say, I probably have a little bit of a different perspective, so I don't condone folks who are just you know, out of control in terms of the things that they're saying without responsibility or thinking about the harms that they cause. But there is a part of me that actually prefers to know up front how someone feels and to deal with that, as opposed to the flip side, which is where you don't know how someone feels and then they do more damage than you expected. And so even when we look at what's happening now in terms of how we define racism, back then we had the signs that said blacks and whites. So you knew where to go to the bathroom, where to drink water. Now the signs have disappeared, but many of those same structures are in place. And because the signs have disappeared, it's a lot more difficult to know which enemies you're actually fighting to address the outcomes that you're seeing that are causing harm on communities. So part of me just prefers to know where a person is coming from as opposed to being blindsided.
I prefer to know that there's not very many of them, right?
To actually know
right.
that there's
to
not
know,
a million.
Right.
Now, what's interesting about that to me, Nikema, is that that doesn't address, at least in your answer, the idea of the gasoline being thrown on the fire through these kind of channels.
Right. I think you're always
like
going
that.
To have that. I'm not saying that it's acceptable or appropriate in any way. I think that we're always going to have folks who feel entitled and lash out as a result of that. But do we stop? It's easy to blame them. As soon as that personality gets in trouble with the mainstream, then they just replace it with another person. So who's pulling their strings? Who's at the top controlling who gets on the air to say what? So that's really where we need to be focusing our attention.
Interesting. All right, next question.
I had a little bit of a comment and question. So I'm a Minnesotan. Can you hold that down a little bit?
Sure.
He's really tall. And as a woman of color in the state, people, the responses are interesting. You know, I describe my experience with racism in the state as I'll go to the co-op and people will come up to me and touch my hair and my skin and they feel very entitled to me. And I want to know, what's the appropriate way to respond to that? Because if I lash out and if I'm angry because people are invading my personal space and they feel entitled to a black woman's body, they're going to think, oh no, she's that angry black woman and I'm so scared. What's the way to do that in this state where the dance is so interesting, where it's not the South? We don't have that history like in New Orleans. What would be the best response so that people here can understand that they think it's a compliment? They're trying to tell me that they, you know, they're happy to see me.
Who are these Minnesotans coming up to you and touching you? That's the thing that I don't know. I've never met these people. Are they really?
Yes, they're around. You'd be surprised. You know, People have a good heart here. I like to believe that, but then they do inappropriate things like that. So what's the correct response?
Sure.
So I think you just touch something on them that's super inappropriate.
Awesome.
You just totally feel them up. Seriously. Honestly.
I think it depends on the situation. I'm probably not the best person to answer, but I think it depends on the situation and what their intention is. I mean, there are times when I have to be a little more stern and tap into my LA roots in terms of a response. And there are other times where I look at the person and see what their intentions were, and I try to just talk to them on a one-on-one. Just, you know, this kind of makes me uncomfortable, and just, you know, what made you do that, and just ask questions. But again, it depends on the circumstance.
Next question.
So our last mayor started a conversation before he left office about growing the city by 100,000 people. Our current mayor has picked up on that conversation. And in a city where communities of color are growing exponentially, but white spaces are also growing exponentially and spaces for black and brown people are shrinking, I want to know, I want some commentary on what does the future of Minneapolis look like for black and brown communities if, you know, the trends, we talked about the disparities that exist here. Well, if those disparities exist nationwide, and we know they do, they might be a little exaggerated here in Minneapolis, but if growing, you know, Minneapolis by 100,000 people means recruiting college graduates and new homeowners, what does the future of Minneapolis look for black and brown people?
I think you'll see more of what we're already seeing, which is black people being pushed out of Minneapolis and into Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center, Hopkins, and places like that, with infrastructures that are really not designed to support an influx of a large number of people who perhaps are from a lower socioeconomic background. And I say that because, according to Minnesota Compass, African Americans, about 37 to 38% actually live in poverty, so at or below the poverty line. And so typically, when you have an influx of poor people, and particularly poor people of color, we're not as excited to see them in a given city or jurisdiction because of some of the stereotypes, because of the other structural inequities, because of inadequate access to employment opportunities. And so when you're looking to grow a city, naturally you're going to go towards folks that you think, in terms of your value system, who are going to contribute positively to the economy, taxpaying citizens, people who are going to go to work every day, who have a college degree. So we know gentrification will happen. It's already happening. And unless some of us are willing to take a stand and push back and ask for specifics in terms of those plans, we're going to see more of that in the future.
And I think, you know, one of the pieces that builds on top of that is to really just support other things that happen just out and about. So not even just jobs. I think it was in the Star Tribune a few days ago. There was an article about professionals of color coming into, you know, take corporate jobs and then ultimately leaving after a couple years because they don't have a social scene or social networks to really tap into. And so I think thinking about not just a number that we're trying to get to or having jobs, but it's about how do we support social systems as well and just fun places to hang out or things that really are relevant to people that are not the majority of the state.
I think, again, this is just really a great question. I think a lot of times when the people of color move here from other places, especially professionals, a lot of times they get directed and steered directly into Eden Prairie, Minnetonka, Wayzata by the people who land them here in a lot of cases. So I know with the African American Leadership Forum, we've met people that have never seen, you know, they may have been here a year or more and have never really seen much of Minneapolis at all. So, I mean, that's one kind of way in which people get steered away. Minneapolis itself has to be very deliberate and planful about doing anything like that. I mean, urban planning is not something that people get right. And if you go to places like Seattle and Portland and other cities, everybody's kind of wrestling with how you get that thing right. Because what does eventually happen, like Portland, is they broke up the most historic. 80% of Oregon's black people lived in one neighborhood of Portland. 80% of the whole state's black people lived just in one area of Portland. And they broke that up. Right? And it was in the name of kind of urban planning and development and whatnot. Now that's a set of social systems that they are having a really hard time getting back. So we would have to get that very right.
Talk to me about some cities that are getting it right.
That are
getting it right?
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, you know, Austin.
Better? How about better?
You know, I think you see everybody's kind of wrestling with this. How can we be a more vibrant, creative, inclusive city, and they're competing even for talent. You see this with the cities I just named, like Seattle and Portland and Minneapolis, and even to some extent the Bay Area, which is dealing with, like, I mean, San Francisco is a totally different place than it had been previously. The price to get in is crazy, but it is, you know, kind of more vibrant and inclusive than it ever had been. I don't know that I have an example of anybody got it exactly right. That's why I caution us to think this through.
Right. It's difficult when you add class into the mix. I think if you were just talking about race, apart from class, you could probably identify some places. But typically, the poor of just about every race get the short end of the stick. So when you go into our state prisons, what you'll find when you poll the African-American men is that many of them are from Chicago, Detroit, and Indiana. So that shows me how, you know, how we send sort of middle-class black people into certain areas. Well, we have this system of social control and racial control that leads poor people of color who move here from other states on a path to our prison system. And to me, that's problematic. And in cities like Minneapolis, in order to push certain people out, the criminal justice system is often used as a tool to facilitate that. And that's another thing that I'm concerned about as well. Closing of schools. And I mean, there are there are a combination of tools that you can use to push certain people out of your community.
Next question.
So I'm an immigrant myself.
Come here this way.
Hi. I moved here when I was 16 via Miami, so Floridian. And my question was more about, so I'm Dominican, and a lot of what my identity is based on my culture, not necessarily my color. My mom's white, my dad's black, but we're Dominican. And I feel like sometimes in these conversations about race, we lose an opportunity to talk about culture. And one of the things that has been kind of interesting to me is that, yeah, we talk about Minnesota Nice and we talk about all these other regional differences, but we're not intentional about talking about how the culture of a group of people, of a culture, of a location shapes the differences in policies. So I feel like we're talking about Latinos all in the same sentence as all the same. We're talking about African Americans as all being the same. So if you're from Chicago, if you're from New Orleans, if you're black, you are the same. And I think that to make this conversation richer, we should talk about culture and what it is, because culture is always changing and it's always evolving. And I kind of wanted you guys to talk about that.
I think that's an excellent point. And when I look at, for example, our criminal justice system, when I look at our public education system, I think that the cultural piece plays a role in who you see being harmed by those systems. So when you have, let's say, African Americans from Chicago, so there was a point in time where some of the projects were torn down in Chicago. People had nowhere to live. And so some of them came to Minnesota thinking that, again, it was a land of opportunity. The reality was that they were from a completely different cultural background, not only from the average white Minnesotan, but even from the average black Minnesotan. And you see the attitudes of people who do not want to embrace people from different cultures. This has its roots in history, and I agree that this is another layer that we need to incorporate into the conversation with voices like yours, who are sort of straddling the fence and seeing that this that there's room for this as part of the discussion. So I think that was an excellent point and something that we need to continue to incorporate in our dialogue.
Yeah, and I think that just adds so many more nuanced elements to it. Because, I mean, if you think just about race, it's really about culture that's at the heart of the problems that people have with race. So, you know, you think about different people that are treated differently because they might pass. So you'll have two people that are of the same race, but of two different cultural backgrounds. You know, if you are a person of color of a particular race and I'm white and we grew up on the same block, you know, we're going to have the same friends, we might watch the same TV show, so you're one of the cool ones, like you're okay because culturally we're similar, versus somebody that grew up a city away is not culturally similar to me. So I think it really is about culture that's at the heart of why race is so kind of salient for people.
I think the question is going to blow up kind of the discussion. I think this is a great question in that we do talk in terms of just kind of this like 1952 black and white kind of discussion, and we've been having it for a long time. And actually, I don't want to belittle that conversation because I think, you know, I'm at the wrong end of it, you know, very
often. It's still unresolved.
So I don't want people to move on as if we've solved that. Now let's talk about everybody. But what I do want to say is young people and newer kind of people putting things, my own kids are multiracial and whatnot, and they're adding something that just blows my mind to the mix of the paradigm of how I've always seen this conversation going. So I think what you have just put on the table is this additional layer of complexity that we're all going to have to wrestle with. Again, the cynical part of me says that I don't know that we're there yet, and even be able to get that, because my mind is even blown in what you just said. I'm trying to put it. It's so many dimensions to what you just said. I'm trying to put my mind around it. So.
Right.
And indeed, this is what we're looking at over the next decade or two decades, is that's the kind of change we're talking about, putting on top of this issue, you know, Somali immigrants, Latino immigrants. I mean, that's essentially, you know, when we talk about growth in Minnesota and demographic change, I mean, that's in one idea. We're talking about all of that, not just grappling with this struggle that is centuries old to begin with. So Yeah, my mind is kind of blown too.
Well, and our public schools are already having to deal with that, you know, with regard to thinking about English language learners and how are you culturally proficient to teach certain children. I don't think that we have gotten it right yet, but I do think that they are forced to grapple with it much sooner than the rest of society.
What's interesting about that with the public schools are there are some places where speaking two languages has been seen as an asset. Like, oh, my God, you speak two languages. This is something we can build on and scaffold on top of. Mm-hmm. Gives you multiple intelligence or whatnot. And we're still kind of in the zone of thinking that it's somehow a liability to the system. Like, it's somehow, oh, my God, you speak two languages. How are we going to deal with this? You know? So I think actually that shows where we are on the kind of milestone plot that we need to kind of advance from that to really start seeing this as an asset.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to compete globally, we're going to have to. That's the bottom line.
Question.
So, yeah, the last question was a really good one, so I don't want to risk changing the subject too much because I think we were getting at something important there. However, I wanted to bring up something relating specifically more to the Twin Cities, which has to do with concentrations of poverty and, you know, the strong correlation with race there, and also the rising cost of transportation. I read an article recently saying that it's beginning to rival the cost of housing, which a lot of people think of as the primary investment that, you know, a citizen is going to make. And so I wanted to ask about efforts to make infrastructure, specifically access to public transportation, and how those might that might be a door to opportunity. Kind of specifically with light rail, I hear so much opposition to that, and I wonder, you know, is that something that kind of fits into this discussion? Is that something that has potential to make communities more integrated? I hear a lot of opposition to it, and I wonder if Minnesota Nice kind of makes its way into that discussion and disguises a lot of, you know, kind of uglier opposition where people claim it's social engineering or things like that. So I'm kind of wondering, is that something you guys think about? Is that something anyone's thinking about?
There are groups who are thinking about that issue. In St. Paul, a couple of years ago, we were having very serious discussions about the potential negative impacts of the light rail within the city. One of the things that was interesting during that time when the plans were unveiled is that folks in the African-American community, the Hmong community, around University Avenue could get on the light rail, but they couldn't get off. And that, to me, is very telling. I mean, the folks had to appeal to the federal government to get three stops added. And once it was done, everyone and their grandma took credit for something that really should have been a part of the plans to begin with. So from my perspective, it was very telling that we didn't want the light rail stopping in certain communities. Because of who we think that the ridership is going to be, the fact that people are getting to work, we don't typically think of folks as on their way to work, or we think of them as dangerous within our society. So I don't think it'll necessarily make communities more integrated. I think there are certain populations that might benefit more than others. And if we don't address these underlying issues that we've talked about in terms of access to equal opportunity, employment, as well as education, it could actually exacerbate the situation.
How does the left in America, which sees it, the white left, which sees itself as an ally, actually fallen short?
I am not answering that.
Like, how much time do we have here? Let's see. I think I got a list. Let me pull
it
up.
Does somebody like know this is a pet thing of a
bartender? I will have. No, I'm just joking.
Bring on the bourbon.
It is a huge issue. I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, it's, yeah, we're stepping on a landmine here because many of you all may fall into that category, so we don't want to offend. But we will speak the truth. There are some real challenges. I mean, I know from legislative advocacy that it's difficult to get DFLers at times to listen to real issues that are happening in our poorest communities of color. And sometimes I have seen some of those DFL allies, unfortunately, place the interests of unions and other groups ahead of what is happening in poor communities of color. So there's sort of a shallow aspect to the relationship. It's almost as though there is an expectation that we're going to vote for you because we have since we voted for John F. Kennedy, and that you don't have to do anything to earn our vote. And that's problematic for me personally, and it's hard for me to align myself with that camp when I see all the harms that have been caused to our poorest communities. So it's unacceptable.
I think one of the things that I've seen most personally is there's a difference between being an ally and intruding on spaces, I think. You know, I think that there's been a number of just organizations or meetings or panels or forums, whatever it is, where white allies are present. But there is a difference in being present and aligning with people and putting yourself in a position where you're controlling the agenda. And so that's the piece that I would add that I see personally.
Mm-hmm. Wait, can you give an example of that?
too many to name.
I don't know if I want to give a specific example. Right.
You know, let me say just quickly about that, too. I don't think the white left is all the same. I think there's this continuum. I break it up. There's like this kind of Humphrey-esque kind of liberal group in the white left, and they're actually not as liberal as they think they are. They're kind of like paleo liberals.
They're what?
They're like paleo liberals.
Yeah. I like that. Paleo liberals.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, so the paleo liberals get on my last damn nerve. Right? Because they know every damn thing. And they know what's best for us without asking us. Now, their children are progressives. So their children are starting to do things like, hey, maybe we should ask you what's best for you. You know, can I come to your meeting instead of you coming to our meeting? Now, that's the children. That's the progressives. Those are the white left folks who actually we can see more as allies, right? They are kind of asking the tough questions and not just kind of following the paths that their parents, you know, followed 20 years ago. And I just want to say, paleo liberals, I don't mean that you really get on my nerves, but if every one of you marched...
Yes, you do.
Yeah, I do. If every one of you really did march with King like you say you did, nobody would have been home watching it on TV. I just want to say that.
Well, and even today, I mean, when the pedal really hits the metal, I mean, when it's seriously time to fight for justice, sadly, most of those folks can't be found. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is unfortunate. It shows, I mean, we're out there putting our lives on the line historically, and the vast majority, the silent majority, was nowhere to be found. Dr. King talked about it. Malcolm X talked about it. It's something that has happened historically and that, again, is impacting us today. So it's hard for me personally. Every time I go to that ballot box, I'm tempted, and then I think, okay, lesser of two evils, and I cast my vote, but it's difficult to be in that position and even trying to explain to my children how they should vote when they get old enough, because when you look at what's happened since we voted Democrat beginning in the 60s, we still have so far to go. I'm wondering, you know, how much have we really gained? Because we were Republicans before that. Lincoln was a Republican, for those who didn't know. and it was once JFK called up Coretta Scott King. We saw that as a gesture of goodwill for the African-American community. And so as a group, obviously there are some outliers, but as a group we started to vote Democratic. And I think we need a new party, the People's Party. Personally, we need a new party. We need to do something different, at least to make people earn your vote and recognize that there is a threat to the current establishment. But that's just me.
This will be my final question. What, for the people in this room who want to actually do something then, tonight or tomorrow, what would you recommend, each one of you recommend that that thing be?
I mean, I would say do your own work. And do your own homework and research and study and, you know, figure out what it is you are trying to do and go and do that. Don't expect somebody else to teach you something or, you know, kind of force feed it to you. But take a proactive stance in what you think that personal work for yourself is.
I think making a decision that you're willing to get out of your comfort zone, learn about an issue that's impacting the poorest of the poor, and then becoming engaged, whether that means calling up a legislator, showing up at a meeting, showing up in the inner city, meeting people, learning what their concerns are, and then working alongside of them to address those concerns. You guys don't realize how much power you have when you pick up the phone and say, I'm demanding a change here, here, and here. The problem is that not enough of us do that, and so things continue as they are. So I'd like to see more people in this room use your voices. When there are key issues happening during this legislative session, show up, sign up to testify if you're comfortable, and speak the truth. See, only about 10 people clapped on there, so that lets me know. We're looking around. Hey, where are all the
neoliberals? I can't improve on that much more, but to say right after this, we're all meeting for our new political party meeting, and you all are going to join
the People's Party.
So this is what I would say. Right now, you know that there is a school in Minneapolis where 11% of the kids are literate and numerate, and that the other 89% are not. And you know that that number is actually not a statistic. That's a human catastrophe. And you know that with certain accuracy, you can predict what is going to happen. Those are human beings who are going to face a life of very certain suffering in many ways that they don't have to. So my thing to you would be to say, number one, it is true that you have a lot of power. And the way that I would tell you to express that power is you're about to go into an election year where a lot of people are going to be coming to you and asking you for your vote. They're going to be coming to you and asking you, will you support them? And my hope is that you would ask every single one of them, what is your plan for addressing inequality? And if the plan sounds good, let them know. And if it sounds like crap, let them know.
What about putting a plug for the Humphrey on Thursday night? The Humphrey, go ahead.
Thank you to our guests, Nikema Levy-Pounds, Antonio Cardona, Chris Stewart. Thank you all so much.
Thank you
all of you for being here tonight and for a wonderful program. We appreciate it.
We should just do that anyways. We should just start that.